Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to another Britflix.com podcast. My name's Stuart Wright, and today's guest is filmmaker Matt Hulse. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
And I should say, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, indeed.
This is your second appearance. You're going to talk to us about your new film, Sound for the Future. You're also going to be telling us about three films that impacted everything in your adult life. But before we do that, do you want to tell people or give people a brief synopsis of what Sound for the Future is?
Well, Sound for the Future, I mean, it could be described in any number of ways, but the sort of the kind of précis that seems to have stuck is that it's the story of Britain's youngest post-punk band, the Hippies, as told by the band's drummer, and I was the band's drummer. Hmm. So this is like 1979. So it's me and my brother and my sister, as prompted and kind of managed by our mum. And we wrote about 4.5 songs. One was about rabies. One was about the assassination of JFK. And the other was a kind of dystopian poetic work that my brother Toby wrote called Terra Nova. And then there were some other songs never really made it onto the tape. And the tape was called A Sound for the Future.
Ah, okay.
So that's where the title of the film comes from. And I kept this tape for decades and always wondered if there was something could be made from this, possibly a film. The original project concept, actually, that was inspired to is form in their late 40s and with the original instruments, and they would do covers of songs that had inspired them from the time, and then those artists would respond in turn and do covers of Hippie songs.
Right.
Which didn't happen, but it's out of the blue. Do you remember MySpace?
Leighton Rocks is my Twitter handle and was the name I used when I got my MySpace page.
Right. Well, the Hippies had a presence there, and out of the blue, this electronica duo from Lausanne in Switzerland got in touch and said, could we do a cover of your song, Dallas City Ghost? I said, yeah, that'd be really interesting to hear, see what you do. And at that moment, I thought, gosh, it would be interesting, if they're going to go to that trouble, it would be interesting to film them doing that. And that's where it tipped over into a film project, even though I didn't go and film them. It sort of suddenly shifted it from being a covers project to a film. And so it's kind of, as a project, it started out in 2010, so it's another slow burn. And yeah, it's very difficult to describe it.
No, well, let me, well, I think it's interesting because on the one hand, it's an autobiographical film, obviously. You're recounting certain aspects of your life through the prism of the band, and obviously the band being your family. that brings up memories of being a family. But also you travel about a bit in the film. You go off to the Far East. You recreate things with child actors playing the roles of you guys as kids, but in the present. So but also part of the film, you actually cover some of the process of that. You know, we see the workshops with the kids.
It's an 18 of them as well. It was quite a big undertaking. There's all sorts of stuff. I mean, there's hundreds of hours of footage of the stuff we shot with them. And, you know, only a certain amount made the cut. They were absolutely brilliant to work with. And they're the kind of heart of the film, I would say. Mm. And yes, we did something rather unusual, which was we had these 18 kids and they all turned up to do auditions. And obviously they in their minds, they thought they were going for one of three roles.
Yeah.
But we knew before we even had the auditions that we were going to cast all of them, regardless of what they did at the audition. And so we had a plan to have six sets of hippies, basically, and to be kind of conceptually willful and say, it doesn't matter if a seven-year-old black kid plays my sister, for example.
Mm.
And as he says in the film, you know, how am I supposed to look like her? I don't even have the right color of skin. You're not even a girl either, Emmanuel. Do you know what I mean? So it was a kind of play, you know, really. It was a lot of play, loads of play and improvisation. But the film also, you know, it's quite dark in places. It touches on some pretty dark stuff from my own experience.
I was going to get to that. I mean, you don't shy away from key emotions and memories of those emotions, plus how people feel today, which is what's expressed in the film. I mean, in particular, obviously, this conversations with your mother, which get very emotional during the movie.
Yeah.
Was that something that you were prepared for, or was that a surprise as part of the process of the film?
I mean, you know, my previous films, I mean, I set about capturing things and then that will inform the next steps. So Ashley and I went to Bristol to film my mum's, and as a first step, you know, without any funding, which is where we got that interview.
Yeah.
And very important part of the film is. And just to give you an example of my kind of modus. So in that scene, she reads out a letter and it says, a letter from a child.
Yeah.
And it's this emotional letter from a child who's just saying, you know, mum, I can't bear it. I'm weeping. When will I next see you? Because obviously this is a situation of divorce. We were living apart from our mum. But it doesn't specify which child it's from. And lines from that letter are extracted and used as lyrics in other parts of the film and voice narration. So it's kind of that letter is unpacked and sort of seeded throughout the 100 minutes. So that by the time you get to the letter, you've already heard some of it without really realizing it.
Okay.
And that happens a lot with material. So we were kind of unpacking ephemera and poems from the time, songs, photos, and then kind of throwing them all up in the air, seeing how they landed.
Mm.
And then with the editor, you know, making the pattern work. I like to say in the Q&As I've had that it's a true story in as much as everything in it is drawn from life in one way or another. We haven't really invented anything such. Mm. But it feels like it's like this crazy kaleidoscopic improvised thing, but actually it's quite tightly structured.
Well, in that sense, then, we're given
in a musical way, perhaps.
Yeah. But given what you said there about your process, then, I mean, a question I ask a lot of documentarians when I have them on is about perception at the beginning and the end. So there's the thing you perceive you're going to make, and then there's the perception of it when you've made it. Now, obviously, given this is about you and your family, what perceptions about yourself have shifted in the process of making this film?
Not a huge amount, because I think my mum always says to me, I was born with full self-knowledge. So, you know, and that's what I was exploring. I say at the start of the film, I want to embody the film. I don't want it to be about these stories. I want it to be it. Mm. So an example of that is, just as an aside, my dad appears in it very, very fleetingly, just says a few words. And audiences sometimes say, well, why isn't your dad in it more? Why didn't you go into more depth? I said, well, because he didn't want to be in it really at all. And that's as much as he wanted to give. So I just thought, well, that represents him. And if the audience feel like, oh, the dad's missing, then that's because that's what it feels like for me in the real world.
Right. So okay.
That's what I want, you know, rather than, you know, discussing that at all in the film, you just give people the experience. Mm. And then they have the experience. That's the hope. And so this is why, you know, my mum's in it a lot, because she's very present in my life.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And my brother's not in the film at all. So
that's true. That's true. Well, no, it's just because obviously we don't often do self-examination to the degree that your film does. Mm. So I just wondered how that, you know, you're having to look at yourself like from a helicopter above, but also you're the person looking in the camera at the same time. So it's like, I just wondered if that affected you. I mean, also, how do you remain unconscious of yourself while trying to make a film about yourself?
It's because I'm a performer as well, so I'm performing myself.
Right. Okay.
If you see what I mean, and also performing as other sort of aspects or characters and responding to things. It's an interesting thing. Has it? I've been asked several times. Was it cathartic?
Hmm.
And in a way, but I think more importantly than that, I don't need to make that film again. It's obviously something I needed to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And now I've done it, it's like, well, thank goodness for that. I wouldn't make a film like that again. You know, at the start of the film, I said this might be my last film, because it felt like, right, I'm going for this full on, as if I'm going to die tomorrow, you know.
Hmm.
And That's the way we went for it, but whilst having a lot of fun as well, and it's really funny in places. And I don't find it difficult to lay myself on the line for my art. I mean, that's once I decided to become an artist, I just thought, well, let's all do it all in, or just don't bother.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm very committed in that way. And
there's no quarter given in this film, Matt. That's for certain. One of the things that struck me that was interesting, and because you talk about yourself being like the youngest post-punk band, and there's lots of scenes with you playing around with Malcolm McLaren's gravestone, which I guess is symbolic of the enduring nature of punk, I think, or your love of it. But I mean, and because I interviewed a writer recently, Richard Cabot, who's written a few books about punk, but punk as in the nature of it, not the genre of music. Like what it, we talked about the idea that, goodness gracious, Rocky Horror Picture Show, because being a punk rock movie, because the original stage play was on the King's Road. You know, they were kitted out with gear from the same shops that then would become, you know, the houses of what became punk rock attire, for want of a better expression. So it's just this idea of, I mean, in your lifetime then, how do you think punk has changed and shaped to suit our times, or is it irrelevant now and it's just a nostalgia thing?
I would say it's post-punk, not punk, that's shaped me.
Okay.
I was too young for the Pistols, really. I remember that there was a record on the radio that was banned, because I think my mum must have spoken about it.
Yeah.
But I was only, what, six or something when that? Mm.
I'm thinking about featuring Malcolm McLaren, who obviously was like one of the Svengalis of...
Yeah, so the reason I don't particularly admire or like him, but my mother does. Within the film it says, you know, mum was inspired by Malcolm McLaren and she saw herself as a kind of Svengali of...
Oh, I see. Sorry, I forgot that.
As he was the Svengali. Yeah, but it's okay. I've been asked that a few times, so I may not have clarified it well enough in the film, but because it would appear that I'm obsessed by him, because, you know, I'm kissing his head Stone.
Yeah.
Sticking my fingers up his nostrils and dancing. But actually, it's me just being a cheeky, irreverent, punky guy towards this man that we should be revered. So, and I think he would have approved of that. So, yeah, I'm honoring, like, it's like, you know, acknowledging Shakespeare or something. If you're going to talk about, you know, he was like the kind of grandmaster, wasn't he, of a certain social concept.
He certainly was a ringmaster for what became popular out of punk, that's for certain.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, but I was just, you know, I mean, 7 or 8, 9 years old, I just liked sticking my fingers up and spitting and doing, you know, just the sort of being like a bit bad, but like not violent, just sort of cheeky, and that all of that appealed to me. And I was very fond of John Lydon. As John Lydon, not Johnny Rotten as much, and followed really early days of Public Image and stuff. I thought that was all really powerful and great. I'm still quite, you know, still quite fond of him. But I think if we can take one thing that's sort of post-punk, is that it's that DIY aesthetic, that you can just create something out of nothing that's on your table, that's already in your room or on your table, and yeah. That is so it's informed my way of working, definitely. And through lockdown, I quite enjoyed lockdown because it gave creative limitations, and from that I produced a huge amount of work for Instagram, performances and poetry and songs and little films, just from what was in the bedroom, really. And I don't think I would have had that capacity had I not kind of engaged with punk and post-punk.
How can people see Sound for the Future?
It is available to rent or buy online via the usual channels, really. It's YouTube, Google Play, is it on Netflix?
No.
Yes, I think it's on Netflix and Prime.
Prime, that makes sense.
No, it's not
on Netflix. You can't rent or buy on Netflix.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so Prime, Google Play, YouTube, and Apple Store. There you go.
Moving swiftly along, 3 films that impacted everything in adult life. I'll just run the rules by the audience for those that are tuning in for the first time. Matt has given me 3 titles, which are films that have impacted everything in his adult life. We are going to talk to those film titles. But Matt is doing this against the clock. So every time we hear this sound... You hear that okay, Matt?
Yeah, I hear that. That's already making me anxious.
So that's the 5 minutes are up, and then we can finish our sentence or two, but we'll move on to the next title, and we'll discuss that for 5 minutes too. Does that seem clear to you, Matt?
I'll do my very best.
All you can do is talk about your memories and why this film is important to you and all those kind of things. It's really, this isn't film studies for the BFI. This is more about our relationship with film as much as anything else.
Okay, that's cool. And that's interesting in relation to what I've chosen. Can I just before we start though, there was there's a film that I'm avoiding talking about in favour of the other 3. And that film is Star Wars 4. I mean, that was my first important cinematic experience, and but I think it doesn't deserve much more attention.
It certainly doesn't need much more attention, but yes,
I
get your point.
There is one thing that I did take away from that, and we were talking earlier about why just certain things from childhood stick in your head, and that is the shot of the land speeders going through the desert, and the light. That's the thing around the light, and that will just as a sort of little prequel to talking about the other 3.
So starting with number 1 on your list, we've got 2000.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
One, A Space Oddity, obviously Stanley Kubrick's masterpiece. Why is that such an important film to you? When did you see it? Where did you see it?
Well, we were taken to, so around that time, sort of late 70s, our parents were divorced. Mum was living in Cambridge, and when we used to visit her in the holidays, she would sometimes take us to the Cambridge Arts Theatre. And she took us to see 2001, A Space Odyssey, when I must have been 8 years old.
Wow.
Which is a bold thing to take a child to.
Yeah, no, it's amazing.
I had absolutely no idea what was going on. No idea whatsoever. But at the same time, it was absolutely thrilling and terrifying. And of course, at that age, you believe the apes are real apes. So all the stuff that now looks a little bit shonky, you know, I genuinely thought they were real apes doing that. Now, there's a few things that really stick out from it is the monolith. Just the presence of the monolith is just, even if I think about it now, gives me, you know, an eerie feeling. And curiously, in Reading, where we were living in term time, there was a development in the Mary's Butts area, which is early 70s, and they were picking up on these hexagonal forms and stuff you see in 2001 and indeed Star Wars 4. And there is this large black triangular clock, like black marble.
Yeah.
That to all intents and purposes is like the monolith. And that's, you know, I walk past that every day. that film is kind of infused into my experience of Reading at that point in time. And what else jumps out? The sequence with the psychedelic tunnel, you know, he's like flying down a wormhole.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then he sees himself on his deathbed and then he kind of turns into a baby by or something. In my mind at that time and in my mind now, I have absolutely zero idea what's going on, except that it's kind of about light, time, to a certain extent, memory. It's kind of about the entirety of life and existence, and yet also about not very much at all, with good costumes.
But also that idea of messing around with time, Kubrick almost introduces the idea of the uncanny then, because we're no longer sure where we are and when we are from that point.
No, and I think you can see that you get. It's really only David Lynch's films that give me the same feeling, you know, as 2001. So it's this tapping into some, you know, the subconscious and kind of basically he's addressing the idea of death and eternity and some massively important things. When you're eight, you just kind of, what is going on? But you're kind of scared because it's so, you know, scared by the enormity of the concept. Is like it's really facing, you know, mortality in a film. And I saw it again recently. I mean, some of those scenes are quite, you know, they made me laugh because they're a bit kind of slightly rubbish, you know, in the production values. And which is a terrible thing to say. I know Kubrick was obsessed about production values, but they did what they could at the time with special effects and things.
Had you, out of interest, had you seen Star Wars at this point?
Yes.
Okay, so you had a space, you had a space opera already sort of already understood, and then you go see this.
Well, yeah, I think so, Stuart. I can't remember exactly because they were, well, like, we went to see Star Wars in the first week of its release in Leicester Square. It was for my brother's birthday, so when I think that's June.
Yeah.
June 77, could it be?
I'll take your word for it. I don't know.
So it's, I think I would have seen it, yes, because then we only started visiting Mum in 78, I reckon.
And what was, sorry, say that again, what was the event that they were showing 2001 that your mum took you to? Because obviously 2001 is a 1968 film, isn't it?
It was just the Cambridge Arts Theatre. It was okay. Just like a local arts cinema, which is now the Picture House.
And do you have any recollection of the conversation with your mother after the fact? Like, the bell saved you.
I can't remember discussing it with her. I can't remember discussing it.
Right then. Moving swiftly along, sir, to 1977 for the release of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, a film I said just before recording that I saw only seen this as an adult, so I'm interested to know how does a child receive this film?
I just absolutely loved it. I think we saw this in a cinema in Reading. Yeah. So by this point, obviously, I would have seen Star Wars and presumably, possibly 2001. So, you know, it was kind of in a realm of films that I was familiar with from quite young. I love everything about that film. I mean, it's also, as I was saying before, that there are some things in it now that are sort of slightly laughable, but when you're that age, you believe everything. Mm. And what I find really interesting is it's not really thought of as a kind of romance film, is it? But it's very, very romantic. And there was some stuff kind of going on parallel with my life at the time. So our parents had divorced, and I'd had that experience of that atmosphere that you get in a home when you're a kid, and the adults are like, you're trying to behave, you think it might be your fault. There's all that weirdness. And they capture that brilliantly in that film. And yeah, it's basically, so it's a sort of story of marital breakdown.
They don't soft soap you on that at all, do they? They basically when Dreyfus's family are out of the film, they're out of the film. He's going forward doing this mad mission.
Well, that's because he built a mountain inside the lounge. You know?
Yeah, that's always going to cause a bit of trouble.
Yeah, it's romantic in that he's looking for this kind of something bigger, something more grandiose, and he pairs up with that beautiful woman that I'm still in love with. In her denim shorts, and they, you know, off they go towards the light. Mm. Light again. Light's so important to me. And to find this sort of sense of destiny. All of that is somehow, it gets a bit overlooked, I think, with all the special effects and all the other stuff. One other thing that really struck me at the time was François Truffaut playing this kind of specialist linguist scientist mashup in his white shirt with his sort of tie slightly ragged, and he is brilliant. And there's this whole scene which I think is absolutely astounding, where you've got the sign language, the hand signs for the five tones, communicate with the extraterrestrials, and that ultimately led to me making that film Dummy Jim, I think. So it gave me an early interest in sign language and the idea of being able to communicate non-verbally.
Okay.
And the connection it there with tones, I think about that quite often today when I'm making music. You know, that scene with the scientists on the ground, and then the mothership, and that communication, and that incredible electronics babbling between the two, joyous thing. That's informed the way I write music I listen to even. So yes, a music concrete kind of idea.
Yeah. I mean, it's amazing, isn't it, that such a simple musical phrase from a movie became, I mean, if you hear it, you know, you're there, aren't you? I mean, even like I say, I didn't see the film until I was an adult, but I knew the musical phrase from the film for a long time.
Yeah, it's brilliant. I did a piece once, actually, it was called Monsieur Hulot's Close Encounters, because I noticed that the main theme from Vacances de Monsieur Hulot is hang on a second, that reminds me of Close Encounters, so I pulled the two together.
Yeah.
Sure enough. So it was called Mr. Hulot's Close Encounters.
One of the things, like I said to you, I didn't watch this till I was an adult. And what struck me watching it in 2022 eyes is that if you look at Richard Dreyfuss's character now and go, who would that character be in a 2022 film? He would be the conspiracy nut bad guy. There's no way he would be a hero because there'd be, the way that the way that we are all so fractured and divided now. That idea of somebody being like destroying a family in pursuit of this mad mission, that'd make you a bad guy. But in this film, they never make him out to be a bad guy. It's like his mission is quite, what do you call it? Honourable's too strong a word, but it's the
calling, isn't it?
Yeah, it's genuine, isn't it? He's not trying to destroy his life, but he can't stop it. He's compelled to do what he's doing.
Yeah, it's a bit of, you could argue it's a bit, I'll finish on this clanger. He's a bit of a Jesus character.
Yes. Which is a lovely segue for your third film, which is The Man Who Fell to Earth.
Yes. The Man Who Fell to Earth. This was another one we saw in the Cambridge Arts Theatre.
Okay.
And we went primarily because it was Bowie. I think my mum already would have known some of Nick Rogue's earlier work, like performance and stuff. But... we were and still are Bowie fans, and we were listening a lot around that time to Changes One, the first compilation, and also Low and Some of Heroes and that kind of Berlin period. So I already had a sense of this mood of Bowie in that realm. I don't remember, like, again, another film that probably we were way too young to be in. Because it's got the whole sort of gun and sex scene, isn't there?
I mean, it's literally an exit certificate, so yes.
Yeah. I mean, there's stuff in there that, which was, I probably would have just had no idea what they were doing, let alone why, you know.
Yeah. Can I ask you then, how do you remember a problem getting into cinemas to what? I mean, obviously, with your mum, but that doesn't get you past being an 18 film.
Well, do you remember Sean Barker, my mum's lodger, who's in Sound for the Future?
Yeah.
He was the guy on the door.
Oh, so wow. Amazing.
There you go. I don't know whether for free, but certainly he would just sneak us in. And you know, my mum's incredibly liberal mother, and she was like, children shouldn't be protected from art, you know, because she knew it wasn't going to be just randomly violent and stupid. She knew it would have some guile.
And I guess if she sat with you, it's not like going watch a film. I'm going off to do something else.
No. And it was Bowie. I mean, we basically forgive him anything except for the Linguini incident. Have you seen that? He made a film called The Linguini Incident, which I think he's tried to bury. It's absolutely terrible. Anyway, so I won't forgive him for that one, but everything else he does, he gets away with in our family anyway. And there's a couple of things I remember specifically from the film. There's one scene where he kind of, so I don't remember the plot. I'm not that interested in plots, really. I'm interested in the light, you know. And he has this kind of pre-internet type setup where he has this sort of globe.
Okay.
And he places it onto this stack of, so maybe it's a pyramid or some sort of system where you put these things in and you can kind of channel all the information from around the world. And this is the point when he's become, I guess, the fallen alien, isn't it? Because he becomes kind of human, doesn't he, in a sense? And that's
it's kind of an assimilation, problems. Isn't there? There's like this
idea. Yeah, and this is when he becomes, you know, like megalomaniac. I mean, he looks brilliant because he's got fantastic shades on and like beautiful silk, and you know, everything looks brilliant, and he's surrounded by all this light and information and becomes kind of all powerful, as I recall. Just there's a lot of interesting landscape in that as well, isn't it? These moonscapes and but one note about that film is there was a retrospective of Nick Rogue's films at the Cinema Nova in Brussels,
right,
and they programmed my short film Hotel Central from 2000 as the kind of short before the feature.
Oh, wowza.
And then the same thing happened at the Film House in Edinburgh as well a couple of years later. And I wasn't there, but Nick Rogue was. So Nick Rogue has seen my short film.
Oh, that's amazing.
And, you know, I wasn't, when we made Hotel Central, I wasn't thinking about Man Who Fell to Earth at all. But obviously to the programmers, it's like there's this really strong connection. So there you go. That film must have had a very big impact on me, so much that I can't even see it anymore, you know.
for others to be able to see it not once but twice, kind of, that is quite an amazing subconscious link between the two that you've made.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose there's a very literal thing in the Hotel Central starts with, you know, there's a guy that, you know, he didn't fall, but he sort of appears on Earth.
Oh, okay.
On bed, but yes, I think it's more the mood of it and the kind of British sensibility as well. It's sort of quite surreal, fashion aware. So stylistically, they may. I need to go and watch Man Who Fell to Earth again. See what it's like. See what it's actually like.
Well, look, that's our time up, mate.
Brilliant.
That was very, very entertaining and very interesting. And wowza, seeing those films as a kid, that's quite a film education.
Yeah. Can I sneak one last thought in on Close Encounters?
Sure you can, yeah.
It's Spielberg's toys moving around on their own thing.
Okay.
Which happens in several of his films. So toys come to life as if by magic, which is, you know, spooky when you're a kid. But that definitely influenced my early work, because the first films I made were stop frame animations.
Ah, okay.
Kind of inspired by, at the time, by, you know, Czech animator Švankmajer. But actually, when I saw the Close Encounters again recently, I thought, it's the magic of that. And I wanted to be able to make things move around on their own.
Indeed. And yeah, because as a kid as well, you imagine your toys having a life, which obviously is brilliantly done on, brilliantly showed in the film Toy Story, but obviously in the them coming alive literally in front of your eyes is a magical thing.
You will it, don't you, as a child?
Yeah, exactly.
Come on!
Well, let's remind people then, how and where can they see Sound for the Future?
Sound for the Future is now streaming online for rent or to buy, and that was, what was the list? It was YouTube, Apple Store, Google Play, and Amazon Prime.
Well, it just gives me to say thank you very much for joining us on the Britflix podcast.
Okay, thanks, Stuart. That was fun. It was really fun.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.